The Gadget Guy on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Welcome to show number 273, where we're going to be looking at passwords and better options for security in time for World Password Day.
That plus the latest technology news. Welcome to The Gadget Guide. And I'm joined by Lawrence McAuliffe for this episode of The Gadget Guide. We're talking passwords and so on in a few minutes' time. But first, it's time to look at this week's technology news. And we'll start off with a new device, a rather slim device from Apple, which is their new launch.
Yeah, this could be a revision of the Apple Pencil, which, of course, Apple fans have known for many years. Although we've gone through a couple of revisions. The most recent one was adding USB-C, obviously an important one to comply with EU requirements, but also just to make it a lot friendlier with the rest of your ecosystem, because iPad went USB-C a little while ago.
And this is the device that you can use with the... Is it all models of iPad now, or just the Pro ones to do sort of more fine-grained input, particularly if you're sort of doing drawing and illustrations and so on, rather than just sort of browsing the web?
Yes, it's certainly a variety of iPads. I think some of the more base level iPads don't support Pencil.
Gotcha.
But certainly a lot of the advanced ones. And I think you can use it on the iPhone Pros, I seem to recall.
Oh, interesting.
Well,
I think that's a reasonably recent addition, hasn't it?
I do seem to think that they added support for that fairly recently. Could be wrong. Anyway, some changes for the Apple Pencil coming up. The interesting one is interchangeable magnetic tips.
Oh, interesting. So this is the bit that I was going to say write with. That's not quite the right word.
I think writing and drawing with. I think that's perfectly acceptable.
Yeah. You
know? I mean, we could be using a crayon, we could be using a felt tip pen, could be using a fountain pen.
And all
or,
of those,
or an Apple Pencil,
and all of those devices. If you were doing this kind of in real life with real ink and or chalk or whatever, all of those will feel differently as you're using them.
Yes. So this gives you the option for things that feel firmer or feel softer, depending on what you're doing. If you're doing digital painting, you possibly want something softer that feels more like a felt tip pen. If you want to do technical drawings and diagrams, you probably want that nice hard. Feels like a really sharp, hard pencil, or even an ink pen.
Interesting. And as well as the different tips, there's also potentially new gestures, new feedback mechanisms. The possibility of a sort of squeeze to do something as a new gesture.
Yes, and a lot of these are currently still rumours and gleaned from updates to the operating systems, where obviously the controls have to be written into the operating system to handle devices, and the dev people who are using the betas of the operating systems can glean a lot of secrets about new hardware from those operating system changes. So these sort of input mechanisms are visible as possible things, as well as, of course, it's been patented. So there is a patent that did get filed, and there's a lot of ideas that can be gleaned from that, like the swiping, the tapping, the squeezing gestures.
With all of these things, you just because they patent something doesn't mean it's going to be coming in the next product.
Nope, could be anytime soon.
But it does have to be something that they disclose before it ships, because with anything patent related, as soon as it's out there in the world, you can't file anymore. So
yeah, it also means that Samsung can't go and take the S Pen and add squeezing gestures to it.
At least not in the same way.
In the same way. No,
they can often achieve the same ends, but maybe through a slightly different mechanism, or the lawyers get a little bit of a field day.
Yes. So we'll have to wait and see. This could be shown off at Apple's Let Loose launch event on the 7th of May, which obviously we will be watching with bated breath to see what else gets launched. Talk of possible changes to the iPad range themselves, possibly the M4 CPUs landing in the iPads announced this year, but we'll have to wait and see. Possible overhauls to the Magic Keyboard, because that's the one accessory that hasn't yet had USB-C.
Interesting. Yes, that's a good point. It's very popular amongst, all kinds of Apple users, but particularly those using the desktop devices, which did get an overhaul. Was it last year, I think? We got some new Macs.
Yes. So we will be watching that middle of May to see what, first week of May, to see what Apple announce, and we will be telling you all about it after that.
Interesting. Heading into the more hardware cyber-related world. And this is a change to the UK's Products and Security and Telecommunications Infrastructure Act 2022.
Yes, that rolls off the tongue.
Doesn't it just? And the idea behind this is that it's set to enforce, if you're putting products on the market in the UK, a set of minimum security standards that you have to do if you're a device manufacturer. Now, there's not a great deal of that you should be too surprised about here, but I think probably the thing that will be the largest change is that devices will no longer be allowed to ship with a generic default password.
Yes, so having Edmund as username and Edmund as password would be an infringement of the Act.
Yes. Now that's something, because a lot of these devices, if they do come with these passwords, they get put into service, the passwords never get changed, and then they get used to compromise it later.
And this could be at home, it could be, you know, your small community coffee shop deciding to put Wi-Fi in for their customers and not being aware of changing these sort of passwords, and then ending up being a security hole where hackers could compromise other security via the coffee shop.
Yeah, now there's various different mechanisms that devices can use to meet these requirements, and probably the two most common ones we're going to see are either per device default passwords. So maybe that's your Wi-Fi router comes with a password on a sticker on the back,
and a QR code, yeah.
But at least it's unique to your Wi-Fi router. Or the other one is that it comes with no default set, and then when you turn it on for the first time, then it will ask you to choose a password, and then you're forced to choose one that's hopefully unique to you.
Yes. I'd like to see things like manufacturers offering you a page you could go to and enter your serial number and the password that's on your back of your device to unbrick it if you accidentally brick it as well.
I think that will be an interesting one, is like, how do you kind of meet the needs of this security standard, which is there for very good reasons. But at the same time, if a device has maybe gone onto the second-hand market, or you've had to reset it back to its default, you don't want to entirely lock people out. I suspect that we're going to see a lot of stuff where it's related to physical presence of the device. So it's a sort of, if you power it up holding down a reset button, then it goes back to the thing saying, and choose a new default password or that sort of thing.
Some of the interesting ones that are definitely in scope for this Act include things like video doorbells, baby monitors, washing machines, and smart thermostats. So yes, all of those smart home things that we've talked about on the Gadget Guide over the last number of years are now well and truly in scope of this Act for making sure that they are secured. We've had far too many stories about people getting access to those sort of devices when they shouldn't have been able to get access to them.
Now, it's not all about passwords, because there's also a requirement that manufacturers publish a date that they guarantee to keep providing security updates for the device. Ooh. So it's like, if you put a smartwatch onto the market, then when you do so, you also say, and we will continue to support this until at least, let's say, 2026. What's interesting is, and that date can change, it can get long further into the future. I don't think it's allowed to go backwards. And I've seen this starting to pop up on a few manufacturers' websites, and noticing that at least in some cases, that date is already in the past. So they're saying, I think I spotted it on some of the Garmin smartwatches, we promise to continue doing security updates until January 2024.
Oh.
That's not a very useful promise.
That's how to make your device obsolete, rather rudely.
They're not saying that we won't do it any further, but they're just not guaranteeing it. And I wonder if that is slightly skirting around the intent of this act.
It does seem to be a little bit of working out where there's a loophole and opening it as much as you can.
Yeah, hopefully that's purely an oversight on those manufacturers.
And certainly we'd like to believe that a lot of our favourite manufacturers are going to be responsible with security updates into the future.
Yeah.
Yes, moving from security updates to theft.
This is an interesting one. It's a problem that's been ongoing for a very long time, and that is the theft of telecoms cables. So Openreach, part of the BT Group, obviously one of the ones to suffer a lot of this. Copper is valuable. You know, if you have a lot of copper cable, then that can be sold for a significant amount for its scrap value. And of course, our telephone lines contain a huge amount of copper because there's one going to, well, frankly, most houses in the country.
And if it's not going between houses, it could be connecting infrastructure that runs bits of that network.
Yep. This is something that's been estimated to cost up to £4 billion. Of course, that's not just the cost of replacing the copper itself. It's also the cost of doing that work and the disruption to businesses and people's lives whilst that happens. You know, replacing some of these cables can take weeks, if not months, due to the complexity of it. It's an interesting problem that sort of feels like it should be getting less bad as we go towards fibre to the prem. Unfortunately, some of the folks doing the stealing aren't necessarily as smart as you might hope, and they're now nicking the optic fibre, despite that having no scrap value at all,
yeah.
But still causing all of the disruption.
So what Openreach have managed to do, and they've worked with cable manufacturers, is to develop a synthetic DNA that they can include in the manufacture of the cable itself, so that the DNA trace in the cabling will leave a recordable fingerprint effectively on people and vehicles that have contact with it.
Interesting.
So that they can prove that somebody who may have been involved in a theft of cable actually did, based on this DNA evidence.
Interesting. Now, presumably, this is similar to the products we've seen in the past, things like Smart Water.
Absolutely.
Where you effectively paint the thing you want to protect in it, and then you can trace that paint onto others. Of course, it does rely on you having at least a bit of a reasonable suspicion of who might have stolen the cable in the first place, because you can't go and look at the whole population of an area. But it may help add to that evidence if you do find someone you suspect.
Yes, this is provided by, and I love the spokesperson from Selector DNA, James Brown, who said that the benefits are twofold. Obviously, it helps prevent crime, but also gives the police that proper forensic evidence that cannot be disputed. If there's the evidence of that stolen cable on you, you're the one in contact with it.
Yep, very much so. So fingers crossed we'll start getting to the bottom of this. Staying with the law, but on a slightly different tack, OpenAI, these are the folks behind ChatGPT and other AI, sort of generative AI systems.
I thought I'd include this because I know how you like an AI topic, but then it included your other favourite, GDPR.
Yes. this is an interesting one. It's a filing based in Austria, and a group has alleged that ChatGPT was asked to provide somebody's date of birth. So you say, hey ChatGPT, you know, what's Lawrence Micheliff's date of birth? And it answered. And of course, that sort of that has two outcomes. Either it gets it right, in which case, well, hang on, how did you know your date of birth? Or it gets it wrong, in which case, under GDPR, that's providing incorrect information.
False information about a person,
and
yes.
And there is a right for data subjects to be able to request false information to be corrected.
you realise I'm going to go and ask ChatGPT when it thinks my birthday is.
Yeah, and so the complaint here, it got it wrong, unsurprisingly. It doesn't know everyone's date of birth. The complaint alleges, well, the controller, OpenAI here, doesn't seem to have any option to actually correct false information. It can only hide it at the final stage of output. Well, hang on, it's still dealing with that personal information potentially ahead of time. So I think this will be a slightly interesting
one. Yeah, certainly I think any lawyers involved in things like GDPR and personal information protection are going to have a bit of a field day on how these large language models can deal with personal information and all of the Act's requirements. And Austria, being a pretty good litigating country, is quite good at setting a precedent for the rest of the European Union. And the UK isn't left out of this party, because GDPR was fully adopted into the UK's laws after leaving the EU. So all of the same nuts and bolts, as far as the law is concerned, work for us in the UK as well.
And I think it will be an interesting challenge, because, of course, you know, large language models like ChatGPT don't actually understand any of these things. Yeah, there's no concept of actually understanding what these answers mean. What they're doing is providing something that sounds like a plausible response in return.
But effectively, it's search results.
It's doing a load of pattern matching.
Yeah.
From the point of view of those making the complaint, they don't care how it does it. That's
but we've,
not their
we've
problem.
Probably all done a Google search. Other search engines probably do the same.
Yep.
We've done the search, and at the bottom of the results, it says certain results have been admitted omitted because of privacy and requests for privacy to be enforced.
And we do already see that on some of the generative AI systems. So if you go to things like Bing's image creator, which you can say, hey, give me a picture of a lady on a train
is the classic, I think, at the moment.
Exactly. And if you say that with, for example, a celebrity's name, then it will say, no, I can't do that. Yeah, I'm not meant to work with personal data. So we're starting to see that evolution, at least on the image side, where, to be honest, there have been much more problematic outcomes to date.
Yes. Sticking with EU law coming after large entities of data, Meta, the owners of Facebook, WhatsApp, Instagram, and Threads, of course, we always forget about Threads being their new baby, are going to be facing an EU probe for not doing enough to stop Russian disinformation.
And this is, again, this is one of those ones that's ongoing with any of these content creation systems, is that it's, Meta's argument is, well, we're not posting the disinformation, it's our users, and they have free speech. The argument here is that Meta are not doing enough to either prevent disinformation being spread, or in some cases, the algorithms which decide what to recommend to their audiences, maybe even inadvertently selecting for that disinformation, often as a result of, that's the more contentious topics. It's the ones that people are getting, very interactive about, and therefore they get recommended as, hey, this might be an interesting discussion point, whether or not it's truthful.
And of course, this is not a unique scenario. The EU has been probing X, formerly known as Twitter, possibly soon to be known as Twitter again.
I missed that one.
Elon Musk, of course, the owner of X and many other enterprises, had posted a tweet this week saying, should it be called Twitter? Sadly, he didn't know how to use a poll to
Elon,
actually do that.
Nobody stopped.
But yes, I think last I looked, which was only after it had been up for a few hours, it had 18,000 responses, the bulk of which said, no, it should be called Twitter. Never stop calling it Twitter.
Yep.
We will be watching that one closely. And then moving finally on to gaming. We like a little bit of gaming news, and we like records being broken on Steam. Of course, one of the world's biggest gaming platforms to find all your favorite games. New release that shipped on the 26th of April, Friday the 26th, called Manor Lords, which is a strategy game set in the Middle Ages and is a city building game.
So this is, think Civilization.
SimCity,
yeah. That sort of thing, but in the Middle Ages. I sort of read their
release about the news of their record that they managed to hit, and thought, yeah, I'm going to have to go and try that one.
Yeah.
So released on the 26th of April, 3 days' time, it had peaked at 170,000 players simultaneously within the first 24 hours, actually, of its release.
That must be really tough if you're doing this sort of game development. If it's a new thing, it's not part of a franchise, how do you predict what your takeoff's going to be like?
Because you have no idea.
You're going to have to spin up a whole lot more servers if it takes off like that. On the other hand, that's going to cost you a lot of money if it doesn't.
It does, yes. And so a few days after launch, it's sitting at about the ninth most played game on Steam, averaging about 73,000 simultaneous players.
Impressive.
So it's actually ahead of things like Fallout 4 at the moment, which is interesting. Sold a million copies in the first day, which for an independent studio is absolutely quite brilliant. And that doesn't necessarily account for people who bought it through Xbox Game Pass either.
Okay, is that
Steam only?
Yeah, that's included in.
I mean, Pell World, which was the one that we talked about a few months ago when it shipped, sold 2 million on its first day.
Yep.
So to actually come second to Pell World,
I think is pretty good.
For an independent studio, you go, yeah, we've done something good.
I wonder how Pell World's going. Are they still going? And have they been sued by Nintendo anymore?
I think it was mainly the add-ons that got sued by Nintendo because they had made things a little bit too much Pokemon-like.
Yes, yeah, indeed.
Yes.
Okay, well, we will be talking about World Password Day and ways that you can keep your password secure coming up next.
The Gadget Guy on Cambridge 105 Radio.
And we are going to be talking about World Password Day. And, well, how can you keep secure online? Because all of us have got more and more accounts on more and more services.
Yep.
And more of those services are having their little security incidents, aren't they?
Yes, so World Password Day celebrated annually on the 2nd of May, and it is a made-up day created by Intel in 2013. So yes, World Password Day celebrating its 11th birthday. It's traditionally a reminder to go and check your passwords and think about passwords. Not necessarily go and change them all on that day, because that would be a little bit of a headache for a lot of people, but just start thinking about them, think about where you use passwords, and do you use the same password in more than one place? Which
yep.
we'll always say is
a bad idea.
Yes.
Yeah.
Of course, as you wake up in the morning, first thing you probably do is grab your phone.
Unlock it.
Unlock it. So do you have a PIN number?
Yep, or a pattern.
These days, pattern. Pretty much all modern Android and Apple phones can do an alphanumeric password as well. So you can actually have letters and numbers instead of a PIN number.
Ah, interesting.
Which is more secure. Patterns can be a little bit dangerous because they are easy to eyeball. Someone can easily spot
yep.
or work out just how your hand moves, what sort of pattern you've drawn. And then, of course, biometrics are a cool unlock for your smartphone.
Yeah, I know. I think it's worth thinking about with any of these things, and the same goes for passwords on any site. Is what thing are you trying to protect against? Because on my phone, for example, I'm mostly doing it so that if I drop my phone, if I leave it on the train, if I do something like that, the person who finds it and isn't being quite so honest is more likely to reset it than they are to get into my account.
Yes,
and so that's the main thing I want to protect against is somebody who finds my phone or pinches it out of my pocket, who doesn't know me, who can then get into my data. Now, that's a very different situation to the password that I've got on my Google account, where I care much more about somebody who's got a lot more time, maybe does know who they're going after.
They don't need physical access to your
yep.
asset.
And so I need a much stronger password, as well as some other stuff we'll come on to in a second, on things like my Google account or my online banking account, where actually the data is the thing that's valuable. If someone just nicks my phone, the chances are what they want is a Google Pixel that they can put on a second-hand stall somewhere.
Yes.
And they'll be happy to get rid of the data.
Similarly with your laptop.
Yep.
You know, if you have your laptop stolen, what do you care about? The information on it, probably more than the value of the laptop these
Definitely.
Days, because on there is, you know, possibly a current session to your email.
Yep.
So it could be logged into your Google account already. It could be logged into all of your social media accounts. It might have, worst case, a password list
yep.
in clear text that someone could use. Now, so thinking about your laptop's security. Now, modern laptops have more options than just entering a password as well these days. So the modern ones that can support Windows Hello
yes.
is quite a cool feature.
Or Apple Touch ID if you're on a Mac.
Absolutely.
Then you just touch the power button and it does a fingerprint read.
Both of those are a biometric login, so they require, you know, your face. And the Windows Hello requires a face that is alive.
Actually alive, yeah. You can't just show it a photo.
Yeah. Yep. It's using the same technology that the Xbox gaming systems came up with to allow you to interact with Xbox in 3D space.
Yeah,
because it's working out that your face is real. You know, it is
actually
alive.
Warm. Yeah, yeah, that sort of thing. I think we've sort of talked about the devices and mentioned there a few times the email account. And I think it's really worth reinforcing that your email account for most of us is the most important thing to keep
yes.
secure. Because it's not just your emails. They might not have anything too interesting, maybe a few cat photos and so on. But your email account is very often used as a way of resetting the password to pretty much everything else. So if your email account gets compromised, you can probably then reset your Facebook account, reset your Twitter account, and so on.
Worse, it's probably the way the bank talks to you.
Yes.
It's probably the way your insurance company talk to you. It's possibly the way that any finance deal you've had on a car or anything like that interacts with you as digitally these days. And one of your keys is
your email,
email address. You know, you filled in an online application for something. What do they need to communicate with you? An email address. Your mobile phone company generally is doing billing to your email address these days, and that is how they would contact you if you lose your phone and you need a new phone or you need a new SIM card. It's going to be all based on that email address. So think about, you know, someone can compromise your email. They could possibly reset things on your bank account or ask your bank to do something fraudulent. They could ask your mobile phone company to send a new SIM card out, possibly change your billing address to receive that SIM card somewhere that's not your own house. And then think about the fact that, you know, people contacting you, like your bank, to verify you are going to phone your mobile phone number.
Yep. So if you take one thing away from this show today, it's that the account you need to protect the most is your email account. So how can we do that? I think the first thing is a password that you use for nothing else apart from your email account.
Absolutely. It should be unique to just your email. It should be a nice strong password. When we say strong passwords, let's talk about strong passwords. So we want a unique strong password. Strong passwords generally are longer than, these days they're saying, sadly, it's up to 10 characters.
Yep.
We used to say 8.
Because need to do a bit better than that.
Cracking systems have got more compute behind them, more CPUs, more GPUs, all of those back-end cloud services can crack, can compute numbers faster, and passwords turn into numbers basically inside the back-end. So 10 characters. We do like letters and numbers together. We like a bit of punctuation, and we don't care generally what sort of punctuation, full stops, exclamation marks, dollar symbols, percentages, all those things above the numbers on your average keyboard. Good to include some of those.
Now, as a really simple way of choosing a strong password, I do like the stringing 3 or 4 random words together.
Yes.
And they do need to be random, so not sort of the cat sat on the mat where you'd find them in a sentence and not anything related to you. But maybe as a quick way of choosing some random words, get the nearest book off your shelf, open it to a completely random page, shove your finger in the middle of the page, and that's your first word.
Yep.
Then do the same thing again. That gets you another word. Maybe exclude things like the or it and so on. Do that 3 or 4 times. Shove a number on there as well.
Shove a number in between a couple of the words.
Yep. And then that is probably quite easy to remember. So,
so you've got a novel here. You're going to generate us a gadget guide best password. Please don't use this password.
Yep. So I'm going for unemployment.
I'm going to pick the next word because that way then we're getting
largely.
And the third word
is college. So there we go. Unemployment, largely college. And I've already remembered that. And that's the best bit about this.
The worrying thing is you're going to remember that for days.
I am. That might be my next... No, it won't. but unemployment, largely college. Nobody is going to guess that. But you can probably make up a little bit of a story,
head. You can change it for yourself. You could say, well, you know, college is important because I didn't go to one. So I'm going to have a lowercase c on college. But unemployment, well, maybe I've experienced that, so I'm going to put unemployment all in capitals.
Yep, and there you go. You've now got a password that's, that's probably about 16, 20 characters long. That's really strong.
Easily.
And I can remember it already. I can already remember that it's unemployment, largely college. And I've not written that down or anything. But that's going to be much easier to remember than something like, you know, AZV5G...
Squiggly bracket.
Exactly. So that's
63.
That's a really good way of of making up passwords.
Yes.
The next bit, as well as those strong passwords, is multi-factor authentication. Because that means even if someone does know your password, they still need something else. And that's passwords, something you know. Multi-factor authentication tends to add something that you have or something that you are. So the something you are might be biometrics. That's your fingerprint or something.
Face IDs, those sort of things.
And something you have tends to be something like your mobile phone or a trusted device or a key, a security key fob. So the idea there is that they have to physically be in possession of something as well as knowing a fact, so that if you've left the something on the train, then they don't know the password. And if they've watched you type your password in, then they don't have the thing. And so you're defending against those two different avenues at the same time. So all of the major sort of web service providers allow you...
Let's run through it. Gmail supports this, plus a whole lot of extra fanciness around Gmail. One thing that you might like is with Gmail, you can tell it that you'd like to log in via a push notification to your trusted device. So that could be your mobile phone, and it'll work with Android as well as iOS, so that when you go to gmail.google.com, it will say hi, and you go, yeah, I'm Lawrence. And then it says, would you like to log in with a push notification? Yep. Your phone will go bleep. You'll have to do your unlock on your phone. So that's your fingerprint or your pattern or your PIN code.
Yep.
And then you can go, yes, it was me. I'd like to unlock my Gmail.
Yep. And so now we've got those two factors, and that's going to make it much harder for somebody to get into your email account. If you are using Gmail, for example, for your email, you can head to myaccount.google.com, and there's a privacy checkup on that, so you can check that you're doing everything that you need to keep that Google account nice and secure. It's really important.
Yes. If you're using Outlook.com, what used to be Hotmail, the very similar features exist for that. I'm just trying to get into Outlook.com to actually check that. But you'll probably find if you go to the right-hand top corner where your avatar is, might just be your initials. You can change it to your own icon or picture. Under there should be an account section, and you're looking for security options. There'll be options to use things like the Microsoft Authenticator, which you might already be using for a workplace account. Your IT department at work may have set Microsoft Authenticator for logging into corporate Office 365. But the Microsoft Authenticator can also do Outlook.com. So one application to do multiple things can be quite convenient.
So there we go. We've now got email account secure, and we've got a nice strong way of choosing our password for that. Coming up in a moment, we're going to be dealing with, well, frankly, all the rest of it. How do we secure the other 50 to 100 accounts that we've got on various devices? You're listening to The Gadget Guide on Cambridge 105 Radio, and well, we're talking passwords and keeping your accounts nice and secure. We've got World Password Day around about this time of year, and it's always good to do a bit of a cleanup of your digital hygiene. In the first part, we talked about how to keep your email account secure, because that's the most important account that most of us have in our digital lives.
Yep. It's our key to all the other assets that we have online.
It's everything else. So most of us have, I think the average is something like 50 to 100 different digital services that we use. And many of those do require a password.
And they're increasing all the time as digital government becomes more of a thing. I know a lot of councils are still catching up on things like your council tax bills are online. But, you know, that means another username and password.
Yep. So we said in the first part that you should always use different passwords for different services. And the reason that we say that is that services do have these security problems from time to time. And when that happens, quite often the passwords get compromised. So suddenly somebody who hacks your Acme Incorporated account and gets your password out of that can then take it to your Flibble account and try using the same password. And so even if the Flibble company was still nice and secure, because you've used the same password across the two companies, then your Flibble account gets compromised. So the best way of doing that is avoiding that is to use different passwords for different websites, different services.
But you ideally do not want to write those down in a book or store them on a bit of paper, which someone could steal or you could lose.
Yep. So we have password managers, and this is something we've spoken about before on the Gadget Guide. And a password manager is just what it says on the tin. It's a way of keeping all of your different passwords secure as you work across different websites, generating you random passwords, keeping them locked away when you're not using your device, but then getting you know, giving them back to you very easily when you actually want to log into Facebook or Instagram or that sort of thing.
Yes. Now, of course, one of the beauties is we said, you know, minimum password 10 characters. Well, your password manager doesn't care how long you'd like it.
No, it doesn't have to type it in. You don't have to type it in. You just copy and paste it.
So going for a 20-character password is entirely realistic, especially since it's going to generate that with rules that you can normally choose. So you can say, yes, I want just letters and numbers, or I want special characters. Maybe I want upper and lower case. Maybe I want a few, a little bit of extra tweaks to the password. And it can generate this random mess you're never going to remember. Can you remember that three-word password?
Oh, what was it? Unemployment, largely college, I think.
Brilliant.
Oh, I wasn't even trying to do that. And that's why that three-word password
works
thing
so
is
well,
so good.
Yes. So it can generate this horrible password you never want to type manually and usefully fill it in for you when you get to the web page where you're going to use that password. What you will start to discover, which gets a little bit annoying, is some websites say, oh, you've put a password in that's too long.
Yes.
Because someone who created the website didn't realize that we might be using these tools to make better passwords than their website has ever handled.
And most of the guidance for designing modern websites does say, put a minimum length on, normally of that kind of 8
to 10.
Don't
worry about a maximum.
Don't bother with a maximum, or make it so long that it's absolutely irrelevant.
64 characters
exactly,
or something,
256 characters,
if you've designed website pages and there is a password input field, that's our recommendation for you. Minimum 8, or well, let's say minimum 10. New recommendation is 10. But let's say, limits are, 128 characters or something like that. So your password manager is going to fill that in for you. It's going to keep those passwords secure. So it's going to normally have a master password. So that's going to be another one of those three or four word combinations, different to your email account. Some password managers let you use two-factor authentication as well. So you can have that master password and a physical key or a one-time password on your phone, those sort of things as well.
And the nice thing is you only have to go through that hoop sort of once per session. So it's not something you have to do for every single time you want to log into a website. It's when you log onto your computer for the first time, right, I'm going to start work for today, or I'm going to start doing whatever it is I want to do, I'll unlock my password manager and that will then be good to use for a few hours
or until
I go away from my computer.
And if you are using a computer that someone else could access that you don't want them to access, think about locking your computer when you leave. Set a password on Windows or Mac OS so that no one else can walk up to your computer and do things.
Yep.
Especially with your digital identity being on that, don't even necessarily trust family members, sadly, because kids are liking to dabble and they are our future generation of hackers.
They
could do something. But worse than that, there is the danger of someone going to a site that they don't realize is malicious on your computer that has your credentials on it, and that site stealing your credentials.
So it's
being in control of your own digital asset there.
And I tend to take the approach that even if you entirely trust someone, you don't want to put them in a position where they could be wrongly accused of compromising your account. So actually, I work in IT. I don't want to know my colleagues' passwords
because I
don't want them to think, oh, I wonder if Rob did that.
Rob see my thing I did online?
I'm not interested in seeing any of that. And I would suggest the same is passwords. I think there's an expression treat them like underwear.
don't share them.
Don't share them and change frequently.
We say change frequently. The recommendations have changed a little bit on don't change them as frequently as you might originally have thought.
Yeah.
When we started with passwords back in the original days of computing, needing passwords, the thoughts was, oh, well, every month you should have a new password.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, can you imagine that 50 times?
Yes. You're just going to get tired of that. Most of the recommendations have now gone to don't worry about changing the password unless it's been compromised.
Yep, you have any reason to suspect it might have been.
So what's interesting is certainly social media, and I've seen this from Facebook, if someone tries to reset your Facebook account, and we've probably all know a friend who has said, my Facebook's been hacked, probably because they use the same password as someone else, but more dangerously, if their Facebook password is compromised, was that password used for their email account? Mm. All those problems come back. But what a lot of things, and Facebook is certainly one, will do is send an email to that primary email address saying, we've seen a reset request for your account. Here's the reset PIN number.
Yep.
And it will send you a string of numbers to enter. And here's where you click and go and reset your account. Now, that means someone has had a go at getting into your account.
Yes.
What you can then think about is, do I need to change my password? Has this stopped someone? Do I have multi-factor authentication turned on? And yes, I do, because it has sent me an email saying, you need to send me an email before you actually do anything. I'm probably okay.
Now, something that I found, because I had a lot of attempts on my LinkedIn account of everything.
Yes.
My password was completely secure. I had multi-factor authentication. They weren't getting anywhere, but they were repeatedly trying. What I did in the end was actually to change the email address on my account. Because my email address is in many different places, and I'm sure it's been involved in compromises over the years. So I made a specific email address just for my LinkedIn account.
Right.
Now,
Rob's private LinkedIn at robsprivatedomain.com.
Exactly. Now, a lot of email providers, and Google is certainly one of these, allow you to have different variations on your email address and use all of those for different services. So with Google, if you have joblogs@gmail.com, you can do joblogs and then the plus symbol, anything you like at gmail.com,
yeah,
and that will get to you. So you can say joblogs+linkedin@gmail.com.
Yeah.
And now, to reset your password, somebody, as well as needing access to your email, also needs to know which email address you used.
Now, that one's fairly obvious, obviously, because
yes,
you've gone but if you went plus
LinkedIn
LN for yeah, LinkedIn,
or even
or LI,
LinkedIn 2024.
When I first start using it, yes, or something like that. Something that makes it a bit more cryptic.
Yep.
Now, you can do the same on Office 365. Your administrator of your Office 365 environment has to turn that on. So you might need to ask them if it isn't working. But if you are on Office 365 for work, you can create, your name plus thing at your work email.com. And that will work. If it doesn't work, just chat to your administrators. They'll probably they might not realize that this is a thing. It's one click for them to turn it on.
Now, as before, you shouldn't be expecting to remember what email address you've used for all of these services in much the same way you shouldn't be remembering the passwords. And once again, this is where your password manager comes in.
So what about the password manager in our favorite browser of choice, be it Chrome, be it Edge, be it Firefox, be it Safari?
Now, I'm pretty okay with this. Different people's opinions do vary. I would say yes, if you're using mostly a password manager for websites and you're using the same browser across all of your devices. For me, that's not the only thing I use my password manager for. I also use it for a bunch of other applications that aren't websites, and I use different devices which aren't necessarily signed into to the browser, my work devices and so on. So I personally like having a completely separate password manager.
Mm-hmm.
I use KeePass, which is open source and free.
Yep.
And
I use LastPass, which is free for a lot of things. They have clawed back a lot of the premium features now, a lot of the features made them premium. I pay for it because it gives me a few more security add-ons, like using one of those hardware YubiKeys to authenticate my password manager's master password. But also, I found that the crafty way to cut my costs on LastPass, they do a family pack.
Ah, nice.
And these family members, unlike things like Netflix, do not have to live in the same house.
Very good.
So if you can find five mates to share a LastPass family account with, effectively you can take the subscription down to, I think it worked out about £15 for the year. So it was tolerable. The premium subscription, besides giving the two-factor stuff, synchronizes onto my phone, so I can use websites on my phone and get the logins and those email addresses that I might not remember that I used very easily. But yes, I use the Chrome Password Manager, the Edge Password Manager, in different contexts for other things. So some of the work stuff isn't in my LastPass. It's in a browser that I use for work-specific stuff.
Yep. And if that's what works for you, if you're mostly using websites on one or two devices, then any password manager is better than no password manager. And we said at the start, you probably shouldn't write them down in a notebook. You know what? If that's what
what was your three-word password?
Unemployed, largely college, I think.
Yes. Yep. So if that's our was it largely unemployed college? No, it wasn't.
Unemployment, largely college.
If that's our three-word password, we can go, okay, so it's a big workplace institution, education institution is what I write down. And from big workplace big staffing institution. There we go. That would get me large unemployment college from something that isn't what I've actually had as my password.
Yeah, but even if you do write it down, yeah, I wouldn't say this is the best option, but even if you do that, someone still has to physically get hold of that book.
And know what it means.
And know what it means. And yeah, for most people, that's going to be pretty hard.
Yeah.
So, you know, anything you can do to use more different passwords is going to be a good way of keeping secure. That's all we've got time for on today's Gadget Guide. We'll be back in a couple of weeks' time with another episode. Have a good day.
The Gadget Guide on Cambridge 105 Radio.